Like the Boy Scouts say, are you prepared? Don't you think that's the most loaded motto in all the world? Have you ever really been prepared for life ever at any given moment? Ever? Except, of course, as a momentary illusion. Euphoria would be a better expression. Yes, friends, are you prepared? All right, that's enough. That's enough of that. Crying out loud, all that horn blowing and stuff. You know, everywhere you look, you run into these scary things that you're not prepared for. I came into the studio about 5 minutes ago, and right there on the desk, just about where I was about to go to work, is this little infernal machine. Listen to this. Can you hear this? It says on it, the clock watcher. And, well, now that's not so funny when you stop to think what it really means. It says the clock watcher, and it ticks off the hours of your existence. And then when you reach the proper moment, listen what it does. Now listen carefully now. Wait, I'll make it work, see. You just wait now. I'll lay this here to one side. It'll watch the clock for us, and it is getting much, much later than you think, friend. If you think you're prepared for everything, you just know secretly in your heart that you're not. It's just a lousy, crummy, euphoric dream to be prepared. Now, when this thing rings, that means that your time is up. Have you ever had a feeling that somewhere in the great cosmos is an eternal clock watcher that rings a bell when your time is up? Listen to it. It is ticking it off. There are few things that are more scary in our world than the sound of time being ticked off. Do you know that just take one look at television commercials and you will find that at least 95% of our commercials are based on that one premise, to avoid the onrushing inroads of time? Really, really. Look at the whole concept of cosmetics. Helena Rubinstein has made an entire career on that, of stopping the inevitable somehow. Nobody grows older on television. Nobody erodes on TV. It'll never, ever occur. And our whole, almost all of America is based on that premise. And do you know that one of the political parties is using it today? One of the political parties has gathered together all the sociables. All the sociables that drink Pepsi-Cola, they're all there. They don't grow older, you know. All of those who think young are there, too. I remember one day walking along 7th Avenue, there's a big sign, you know, and it shows these young, skinny people. You know the people that are in all those ads. You know, you never see little old gnarled people drinking pop or any of these things, Yoo-hoo or any of that stuff. And here are these two tall, skinny people wearing leotards on their sole, everywhere else. You know, they're all leotarded up, and the guy's got the sweater tied around his neck, and they're lounging over the barbecue in the back. And here's an old 80, honestly, it sounds like a cliche. It would have been a great Norman Rockwell painting. An old 85, 95-year-old lady is walking down the street, and she looks up, and it says, for those who think young. Nothing is sadder than an 84-year-old guy drinking a bottle of Pepsi-Cola. I'll try to make the scene. Uh-oh, listen, it's about to go off. It's about to go off. And before the bell rings, before the bell tolls for you, we'll take time out for a brief word from the official people.
Know what the new 1964 Super Torque Ford's got? Ask Joni Summers.
This Ford's got a solid, more silent ride now. Step inside now. It's the best-built Ford in history. This Ford's got performance that's total pleasure. Performance that says you're in the best-built Ford in history.
Drive the solid, silent, super-torque Ford for 64 and discover what total performance is. Born in open competition, the 64 Ford is measurably stronger, smoother, and steadier than any other car in its field.
It's as can be. It's the best-built Ford in history. Hurry down to your dealer and get the key to a Ford for 64.
At your Ford dealer, September 27th.
Well, of course, we all have our dreams. And a couple of nights ago, I brought home from one of these store these stores where they sell remainder books, you know, where there's a stack of books. Nothing is sadder than remainder books. Somehow, I don't know, somehow this is a terrible, terrible thing to go into a place. And you know, I don't know whether they have them in your town, but in most of the big cities in America, they have remainder bookstores now. Now, what is a remainder bookstore? Well, this is a place where they sell leftover unwanted dreams and concepts, ideas and premises and stories, even lives, you know. You go in, there'll be a biography. It's a remainder. You know, say the life of General L.B. Watanabe. Nobody wants it. And there it is. There's 500 of them piled up, and they're for sale. Now, one of the saddest aspects, though, of the remainder bookstore is that they even place, let's say, a price value. Some are more remaindered than others. That's depressing, you know. And they range all the way from the bottom, which is 19 cents. Any book on this counter, it says 19 cents. And you'll get books that'll say The Internal Tax Structure of Cass County, Michigan, 1957. Or you get all these little vanity books, all pop, and it'll say 19 cents. Then the next group will be something like 49 cents. Then there will be the 59 cent, that's the more standard remainder. And then there will be the one that says, any book on this counter, $1. And of course, then you're a really top remainder artist. If you're on the $1 list there, you're up there with Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris and all the big guys. But you know, I saw a friend of mine. I'm not going to tell you who he is. It doesn't make any difference because it was just a sad story. But a friend of mine worked about 2.5 years on a book. And he really did. He'd sweat, and it was his whole life dream. You know, he was a young writer. He'd come out of one of the big colleges in the Midwest, and like everybody in the colleges in the Midwest, he had the great novel percolating there in the brain, and he worked on it. He had notes, and he went all the way through his junior year, and he took all the creative writing courses, and he was dedicated. You know, the flame of creativity burned bright and hard in a cold blue light in him, and he was always made, you know, that look, the cynical look of the writer as he sits there drinking his malt, looking out over the shallow people, the callow ones who are up in the front there knocking down the coast. Life is a dream, you know, that kind of thing. And so he kept making notes on his novel, and about his last year, just before he went into graduate school, he seriously started to work on the book. He worked and he worked and he worked. And so help me, it was 2.5 years. And he got in touch with the agents in New York, and they worked back and forth, and he was on the plane and the whole jazz, and he kept sending all kinds of rewrites. And it was a big shlemo, you know, the whole thing. It went on and on and on until finally the book came out. And I remember the day that it came out, all the excitement. And we had a party. We went to the whole thing, you know, and his agent had a party where they had boiled shrimp, and everything was beautiful, you see, which incidentally he paid half for, I understand, later. And he invited all of his friends and the press, including two or three guys who reviewed books for neighborhood weeklies, that kind of thing, and all the press came, and everyone was all excited. And we could hardly wait for the New York Times to come out the next week. And the word was out that the Times was going to give it a big review. You know, that's always talk. Well, nothing happened. They didn't even review it. And 2 weeks went by, 3 weeks went by. And finally, there's a little thing way down at the back of the New York Times book review section. It says, other books published in the past month. And there were all kinds of things like Auction Bridge Revisited, that sort of thing, you know, and the story of Tippecanoe County. And way down at the bottom, it had my friend's book, something like Hearts Aflame, or The Burning Tree of Existence, something of that nature, his name after it. You can always tell an author is very serious. Either he uses only his initials, like J.P. Marquand, or else he uses three names, Albert Payson Terhune. Now, my friend was a three-namer, actually. He had all of his names all lined up there, and a junior afterwards. And underneath, they had a line that told what the book is about, and it had The Burning Tree of Existence Revisited. And underneath it, it says, a boy grows up in the Midwest, and life is hard. Well, he was very hurt, you see, and he says, well, I guess what they're doing is waiting for the Christmas, the big issue there, to come out with it. Well, a couple of months later, when his first returns began to come in, it seems like in the first month and a half, his book had sold just under 100 copies. The first run was 3,000 copies. They had sold under 100 copies, and he says, well, it's going to take off at Christmas time. This was about November. You know, that's when the books really start selling. Well, he got his next return, roughly February, something like that. And in February and December and the previous November, he had sold 78 copies. So it was going downhill. You see, he says, well, I guess we've reached our peak. And by now, the shades of disillusionment were beginning to set in on him, and he began to make like a real writer, like, well, the American people just don't read. They were saying things like, they're just not ready for what I've got to say. Well, the question, of course, is whether they ever will be ready for what he has to say. That's another problem. But then one of the greatest moments of my life, I should say in a negative way, I'm not gloating over this, was the night I am out with him. And just one of those coincidences. We're walking down through the main section of town here, past all the remainder bookshops, and what do you see in the middle of one of the windows there? And there it was, amid 5,000 others, it says, any book in this window, 49 cents. And there was a stack of the Burning Tree of Existence Revisited. There was a stack of them there that was about 7 feet high and about 8 feet across. You know, they're all packed in there. 49 cents. And he's looked, 2 years of his life is in that window. Remember that. It's just not a book. It's his whole burning, terrible, gnarled existence, kind of trying to preserve the flame of beauty in the incomprehending fastnesses of the Middle West. And he stands there, and right next to it is a book called something like Pinochle Revisited, you know, that kind of thing, and learn plumbing in 7 easy lessons. And over here is a picture book of World War I, and over here, all that stuff you see. And right in the middle of it is his book. Well, we go into this place, And here they are. There's a table full of them piled up. He didn't know what to do. Either you buy them all and take them home. They're my babies. Get them all of it. Or else you pretend that you didn't write the book. Do you go around and tell people in the remainder bookstore, that's my book over there, and the remainder kind of the one next to the tax thing over there, the one over there, the memoirs of Cecil Beaton. There they are. It's over there, next to that stuff over there. And he sort of wandered around, and we stood in that remainder bookshop for about a half an hour, and it began to be, what began to be a terrible realization is that the remainder book buyers were not buying. How would you like to be not? They'd pick it up and they'd sort of look, you know how people look at a book, and they'd look at the back cover, and there is my friend's picture looking out, and he's hiding over there behind the book racks. He's peeking out to see if they, and they'd look, and they'd look, it's just the young author, you know, the usual stuff. The young author lived a life in the Midwest that he has put down in searing, burning prose. You're a real fine. A new literary luminary has arched into the sky of New York. He will be ranked with Hemingway, Faulkner. And he's looking at this thing. And the guys, they look for the sexy parts, you know, look like, and you know, they look like that. Nothing, you know, the sexy parts, they start putting it down. And you know, he wants to come out and say, look, I wrote it here. I'll write my name on it here. I'll sign it for you. Do you go to an autograph party at a remainder bookstore? Really? Do you autograph your books down there? Well, boy. Well, we wandered out. You know, it was a sad moment. I didn't know what to say to him. I didn't know what, you know, I didn't say, well, you know, at least your books are still around, Charlie. We wandered out. And we went on down Times Square. We go past the shooting gallery and past all these terrible joints, you know, where they're selling little hats that say, I love Mickey Mantle and Whoopi for the Beatles and all that stuff. We make, and they're selling, by the way. All that stuff is selling. The Burning Tree of Existence Revisited was dying. So we make a big loop. And we make a great big loop, and we go under the marquee, you know, and the marquee there is has one of these $18 million movies, you know, one where they had taken a real potboiler, and something like a Peyton Place, something. And we walk under this gigantic marquee, and we go past this marquee, and we go past the place where the guy is selling the Donald Duck hats, and all of a sudden he turns to me and says, "I'm going to sell out." He says, "I'm going commercial." "I'm going to sell out." One of the saddest lines I've ever heard. And speaking of selling out, we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Best of Bavaria.
Busch Bavarian brings you the best of Bavaria. All the old world smoothness of Bavaria's fine beers. And as refreshing as Bavaria itself.
Best of America.
Busch Bavarian brings you the best of America, brewed light and lively, for modern America's own relaxed way of living. Enjoy new world lightness, old world smoothness, the best of two worlds.
Busch Bavarian beer.
The best of two worlds in one great beer.
Busch Bavarian beer.
At popular prices.
Friends, have you ever thought you'd like to sell out? The only trouble is you can't find where they're buying. Well, I keep getting letters from guys that listen to the show. Say, "Shepherd, don't sell out." Friend, I have been looking for the buyers for years. If anybody comes along and he's got the right green stuff in his hand, old Shepherd will be on there. He's ready to go. Let me tell you this, one of the most discouraging things discoveries I've ever made in life is that the artist who doesn't sell out and who never sells out is rarely asked to. And that is one of the saddest discoveries I've ever made. I've known so many artists who you know, they say, "Ah, boy, any time, look at Rockwell, Norman Rockwell, oh, my God, right, look at the junk." And all of a sudden, the phone rings, and there's a Saturday Evening Post on the line. They said, "We want you to do 8 covers. We want you to go down and paint all these little grandmas and their little spaniels." And the sweat gets out of them, and I say, "Well, wait a minute, Rock, where are you going?" He says, "Well, you see, look, I'm not really selling out. I'm going to give them a new concept of grandmothers. I'm going to give them a new concept of little spaniel dogs. I'm going to revolutionize the Saturday Evening Post cover." And he goes running out. It's pretty hard to tell, you know. I've always been interested in these novels of the sellout. Oh, yeah, there's always one on the market. A young man who comes into the big city with idealism, with drive and ambition, and how he finally sells out to the forces of evil and the forces of big finance. What do you mean, sells out? speaking of the sellout, I think we ought to give the time. Is it time to give the station a break yet? No? All right, these guys, they'll sell out when the time comes. Don't you worry. You know, speaking of the sellout, I was walking along this Remainder bookstore here the other day, and I came across a book about John Dillinger. Now Dillinger was a great hero during my very early festering youth, and he was a hero, strangely enough. And for those of you who never heard of Dillinger, I can only say, how it's impossible. I don't suppose you haven't, because he ranks with George Washington. He ranks with Abraham Lincoln and Jesse James among the great American pantheon of past heroes. And of course, since I lived in that area of the country where he worked, this is where Dillinger worked. He flowered. He came out of the northern Indiana area. He was a part, just a fantastically involved part of life in that area, in that country. Just like if you come east, everybody here worships at the shrine of Moss Hart. Or some other big showbiz hero. He's all involved in this world out here. And if you go west, I'm sure way out on the far west, there is a local hero there, somebody who was part of the past of and the attitudes of California, probably C.B. DeMille, somebody like that. Sim Goldwyn. It's all part of the world out there. Here in the Midwest is where Dillinger, or he called it Dillinger, you know. Yeah, he called it. It had a hard G. It was a Germanic name. It was Dillinger, And even though the public pronounced it Dillinger, he always pronounced it Dillinger in the entire family, some of whom still live in Mooresville, Indiana, which is a little soft country town south of Chicago. And it still is a little soft country town. Well, Dillinger came out of that little place there where on one street, you know, the Baptist church, and down the street is a Methodist church. And he played on the church ball team and the whole thing. And John Dillinger came out of that area and was part of the warp and the woof of the life of the time. Well, I take a look in this remainder window there. You see, it says, by George, the Dillinger days. And I sort of sneak in there, and here's Dillinger on the cover looking out, you know, that kind of vaguely amused look he always had. You ever see pictures of him? Well, I'll tell you how he looks. Almost exactly like Humphrey Bogart. He started Bogart, the whole concept of, yes, he did. He really did. Do you know that Bogart, now I'm going to tell you something you probably don't know, that Bogart was first cast in his first Broadway play as a gangster. He had done a couple of little romantic things. As a gangster because of his facial resemblance to this guy, to John Dillinger. He looked almost like him, and there was a play written about Dillinger. And so this was the big break for Humphrey Bogart, and he later on utilized it. But here, Dillinger was the real-life Bogart, you know, that slightly amused, a cigarette hanging, and kind of a vague sense of, well, we're here just for a minute, we're having a wild scene, let's fly through the flame, baby, let's shoot him down on the way. And he's standing there looking out, and I'm standing out on Times Square, see? So there's the two of us. I'm looking in, and Dillinger's looking out, and I wind up in the place buying myself a copy. Well, a couple of days ago, my mother is visiting me. Now, she came right out of the Dillinger area. I mean, this was an operating lady during that time. You see, I was just a little kid, so I don't really remember a great deal about it, but my mother was part of it, see? So I said, Ma, do you remember John Dillinger? And she put down her cup of coffee, and she looked at me, and there was that brief moment where all of a sudden all the years had disappeared. It was like, do you remember your first really important boyfriend, Ma? You know, nobody ever asked their mother that kind of stuff. Ma, do you No, you don't. I says, Marty, she turned to me and she says, John Dillinger. You know, it had the sound of romance, pathos, lost opportunity. And I said, well, Ma, what is this with this Dillinger? I mean, I just asked if you remembered him. She says, you know, I always used to imagine myself as a gun, Ma. I says, Ma, what is this? And she'd chuckle. Yeah, she did. She laughed. She says, yeah, I always thought that I'd make a good gun, Ma. Well, you never saw a more chenille bathrobe mother in your whole life. I mean, she was strictly chenille bathrobe and scrambled eggs. She spent her entire life with her hair up in curlers, you know, looking out through the geraniums, out through those tangled clotheslines. Somehow she imagined herself in the front seat of a Hudson Terra plane with the roar of Thompson submachine guns and the glass shattering, and they're roaring up to a roadblock, and boom, they go through, and John says, down, Annie, back in the back seat, down, the rats are after us. And she could see her life running like this. Baby-faced Nelson says, oh, hold it, here they come. And my mother, you could see herself hurling herself across baby-faced Nelson to shield him from the hail of bullets that were coming from the dreaded G-men. Oh, man. Well, no, she really did. And I'm not inventing this one bit. She imagined herself this way. Now, no one has really quite put this down on record. Everyone likes to assume that all the women of America imagine themselves as movie stars or as Geraldine Page or Audrey Hepburn. Not a bit of it. I would like to say that half of the ladies of America imagine themselves wearing a very tight red dress, walking under a lamppost at 3 o'clock in the morning, operating some kind of an interesting trade of one kind. Oh, yes, I'm serious. Oh, well, that reminds me. It's time for a commercial here.
Come to me, baby. Come to me, baby.
He's Marvelous Mervin, the rock and roll rage.
Oh, Mervin!
But in the close-ups, off the stage,
hey, Mervin!
It's his breath. real bad. But his breath would come clean if he'd chew dentine.
Dentine?
Dentine. It makes the scene, cause it cleans your breath when you haven't got a brush.
When you haven't got a brush?
Dentine. Now if Merv gets the message loud and clear, this is what you're bound to hear.
Oh, Mervin!
His breath's real clean. Know what I mean?
I got wise to that gum dentine.
Dentine?
Dentine!
Cleans my breath when I haven't got a brush.
Dentine.
Come to me, baby. Come to me, baby.
Now Merv's the rage on or off the stage, and he owes it all to dentine.
It cleans my breath when I haven't got a brush.
Mervin.
Yeah, babe.
Hush.
Now I don't like to sound like a cynic, but this is an often confused thing in our world that if you're realistic about something, you're called a cynical. You're really called cynical, you know, and that's a very different word. The word cynic has nothing to do with realism. In fact, most realists I know are literally the eternal dreamers. These are the real idealists. And my mother, talking to her later about Dillinger, I said, Ma, what about Dillinger? What do you remember about Dillinger? And she says, do you remember the lady in red? And I said, Ma, yeah, I read about it in the book. I remember something about it. She says, well, do you know that when we were on our vacation? She says, do you remember when we were on our vacation? I said, no, I don't. She says, but when you were a little kid, we went up to Michigan, up in the lake there, and it was in the middle of summer. And she said, we were getting the paper. I'd had to come into town every day to find out what was happening to John Dillinger. Of course, he was in the headlines every day. You know how long his entire career lasted? Actually, this is a funny little inside story. Here's a man who created a legend, a true legend. And he is legendary because I think the only people who ever attain legend are the people who, in many ways, the fact far transcends the imagination of people who create ideas. In other words, if Washington is a legend, one of the reasons he's a legend, of course, is because of the way he was far greater in many ways than the ordinary man could conceive of a person being. He became legendary. The stories about him became so involved and so completely removed from the reality of everyone that he was a legend. Lincoln was a legend. Jesse James was a legend. And so finally, John Dillinger became a legend because of the way he was. He was totally different from what you would think a mobster would be like. That's what gives legend. A tough guy isn't a legend. Dillinger was not. He was deeply involved with the movies, for example. He loved to go to movies and ball games. He was always at the Chicago Cubs ballpark, and he was terribly influenced by, of all people, Douglas Fairbanks. He was a real nut on Fairbanks, and of course, since Dillinger was a tremendous athlete. And Fairbanks was too. You know, Fairbanks was probably the greatest athlete who ever worked in the movies. If you ever see any old pictures of Douglas Fairbanks, the immediate thing you think is he must be using a double because of the incredible stuff he would do. You know, hopping up on top of things and swinging down from rope ladders. And he loved to do this stuff himself. In fact, he invented the style. Well, Dillinger loved this. Dillinger just absolutely loved this kind of action. And so whenever he's robbing a bank, he would come in wearing a straw hat cocked, you know, and carrying that submachine gun under his arm casually, and he would just go, whoop! He'd hop up on the counter, 6 feet high. He's up on the counter, and he looks around, he says, it's a stick-up. And everyone watches, the hat is cocked. He's got the funny light in the eye. Oh, he was a wild guy, you see. So my mother, of course, knew this. Everyone knew this about Dillinger. And he became a tremendous legend. And not only a legend, almost everybody is vaguely in love with a legend. This is the way a legend works. You have to have mingled fear, awe, love, and hate to create a real legend. And it cannot be clean cut. And so Dillinger was a kind of a legend that everyone secretly wanted him shot. And they secretly wanted him to get away. Let's say they publicly wanted him shot, and they secretly were disappointed when he got it. And this is really what happened. And she says, I'll never forget that when we were on our vacation, we had about a week to go, and I came into town to get the paper. She said, we were following because there was a lot of stuff in the paper about Dillinger being being pursued in Chicago. There were rumors that he was in England. There were rumors that he'd gone all every place in the world, but they had stuff about him being pursued. I bet you can't tell me the name of the G-Man who became an international hero because of the part he played in the capture of John Dillinger. Oh, come on. They even had a comic strip about him. He became, they even had a radio show about him. That was a continual radio show where he was the star of it. And he became the first genuine G-Man star. He was the epitome of the G-Man. Now, who was he? I'll give you a clue. His first name was Melvin. It's a funny name. Come on. Come on now, this guy, how's that for fame? Here's a guy who was an international star, so much so they made movies about him. He just died a couple of years ago. In fact, he died in 1961. And he personified the G-Man. When the G-Man became a really, you remember they always used to talk about the G-Man, all kids wanted to become a G-Man. The whole idea of a G-Man, it was as exciting as being an airplane pilot. But being a G-Man was a very big thing, and he was the personification of it. He was a star. In our day, he would be on the Ed Sullivan Show. He'd follow the Yale marching team and the whole thing. He would say, and now in the audience, the big shoe tonight, there he is. And they'd pick him up. He'd stand up and he'd doff his... And he looked very dapper. And he was, in a sense, the forerunner of a lot of the radio series of the period because he became famous. He was one of the only guys I ever heard of in my life who had a houseboy. He was famous for having a houseboy. He was a dashing bachelor who dressed absolutely to the very peak of natty fashion. And he always wore a big white felt fedora and jazzy pinstripe suits and a bow tie. And he had a houseboy and he drove a big famous car. He drove an Auburn Speedster. He was really, in a sense, the guy that inspired the Green Hornet with Cato. Yeah, he did. Now, what was it? Of course, and he was hated among other G-men because they said, you know, he had his great flow, the showmanship business going on. What was his name? Come on, you guys. Well, my mother said that she got the paper that day in Michigan, and she says there was the headline. Dillinger nailed. Dillinger was shot outside of the Biograph Theater in Chicago, and practically the entire Midwest went into mourning, including the guys that had been shot. You know that there must be at least 5,000 guys out in the Midwest whose entire fame in their community rests on the idea that they were once shot at by Dillinger, or Dillinger once robbed them, or they were once in the bank when Dillinger came in and held it up. Yeah, this is like seeing Jesse James in action. Speaking of Jesse James, we got a couple of spots here. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Okay, how much time do we have in there, huh? Come on, quick. 15 minutes? 15 minutes, okay, all right. Then we have just enough time here I'm not going to tell you the name of this G-Man. I know a lot of people are going to get mad, but I'm just going to tell you this, that if you are an insufficient American, I mean, you may be a very imperfect American, that is not my problem. If you do not remember the folk heroes of our time, well, then I'm sorry, Dad, I'm not the one. What was his name? Come on, you guys. Crying out loud. You know, you've got to understand that the attitude of realism that the people of that type, that country had, came out of the country itself. In fact, my mother, I remember her saying about Dillinger, she says, he was very nice to his family. Well, that was enough. That was enough, and he was, you know. He was constantly going home to see his father. Can you imagine John Dillinger arriving? The G-men are all around the farm out there in Mooresville, Indiana, and everywhere, people are looking for him. He's the most haunted, the most wanted criminal ever, and he arrives on Sunday, and what do you think they have there on Sunday? They all sit down and have a big roast chicken. They have a Sunday dinner. All the nephews and all the cousins come from all over. It's a typical Midwestern Sunday dinner. And then they go out on the lawn and take pictures. you know, family pictures. The G-men are skulking in the weeds, you see, out there. They don't believe he's there. That's the whole point. They just couldn't believe he was there, you know. And they had gotten a tip that the Dillinger is having Sunday dinner over at the house. He says, oh, come on, get out. We're watching the house. And here they are out in the back next to the snowball bushes. And Mr. Dillinger, the old man, is taking pictures of his son, and his son is posing by the snowball bushes. And here he is. He's got his Sunday suit on, John Dillinger, and he's smiling at Dad, and the picture's being taken. And what do you think he is cradling under his right arm? That great big can of, that great big clip of ammunition hanging down there. And there he is. It's like the son has returned home from the big city where he's making good. And, you know, it's like I'm sure that Hemingway, when he came back to Oak Park and he's having Sunday dinner there at home and he's come back from Paris, he comes out in the backyard and his dad takes a picture of him holding his typewriter. And he's got his typewriter holding there. Well, John had his Thompson submachine gun under his right arm and he's standing smiling. And it had that wonderfully, I suppose you can say, familiar look of the Sunday afternoon picture with the Brownie box camera. You know, that vaguely fuzzy outlines where the film sort of is bad and so on, and there's a thumb of somebody over the thing and they're taking a picture. And then there was another picture of John standing there with his moll. And there they stood, and you could see they just had a big Sunday dinner, and she was wearing her Sunday dress, and he was smiling at Dad, and you could see the snowball bushes behind him, and it had absolutely the same look as that Sunday picture that is taken millions and millions of times in America every day. Now, let's take Johnny out in the back, and we'll take a picture of him with Betty. Come on, Betty, come on, smile at the camera. And Betty, of course, was the girlfriend. They never looked upon her as the moll. She was the girlfriend. And here these two had been running ahead of a hail of bullets all over the Midwest. A great scene. So you can understand why the Midwesterners related to him. And so, you know, my mother says, well, you know, he was very good to his family. So I've learned one rule. No matter what rottenness you're up to, friends, if you're good to your family, you will be loved in America. You really will be. Al Capone was loved in America, in Chicago, and you couldn't get many people to get mad at Al Capone in Chicago, according to my mother. And the reason, this was very evident, because Al Capone was good to his family. They would say, now, he's very nice to his mother. Well, all gangsters have been traditionally nice to their mother. In fact, did you know that Al Capone at one point, when he was at the very peak of his career, when he was really, you know, really he had the whole city under his thumb, he had little soup kitchens where he gave out soup to indigent guys living in the bad section of Chicago. And everyone loved him for that. And that's exactly the kind of thing John Dillinger was noted for. In fact, there was one moment when, in one of his robberies, when Dillinger had a guy here. Can you imagine this scene? Now, this is what contributes to the legend. They came into this bank, and here is a man, just an ordinary customer. There, he has just cashed a check, and the guy, they've given him $150 or whatever it is he's cashing. You know, this is his paycheck for the last couple of weeks. It's depression. Remember, it is really in the real peak of the depression. Dillinger comes in. And his gang fans out immediately. All right, it's a stick-up. Okay, here we go, here we go. All right, and they got the bags, and they're putting the money in. And Dillinger says, did you just cash a check over here? And the guy says, yeah. He says, give me the check back, Mac. He says to the teller. And the teller gives the guy the check back, and he says, give him the money back. And the guy gives him the $150 to the teller. He says, we don't want your money. We're robbing a bank here. And so the guy's got his check back, and the $150 goes back to the teller. Dillinger says, all right, in the bag, Mac. And he throws the money in. Well, you can imagine when this guy got out on the street what he said about the John Dillinger gang. And he says, well, you know, he says, they told me they were robbed. Of course, everybody in the Depression was mad at the banks anyway. The banks were the big villains in the Depression. Would you get mad if, let's say, they robbed the Ed Sullivan Show? I'm serious. Would you get mad if they came in and they robbed I've Got a Secret? I mean, it's your enemy, you know. It's the enemy. You don't get mad. You kind of applaud it, you know. Hey, did you hear what they did? Oh, hey, wow. Well, we're crying out loud. They got Ben Casey on the way to the bank. Yeah, they got the whole shamu. They robbed the whole business there. Yeah. You know, on one hand, you'd be sad about it. On the other hand, speaking of bank robbers, let's give them a couple of minutes here, huh?
Oh, no. don't tell me I've lost all my money.
Oregon salesman loses $140. Chet Gould reporting for American Express, the company for people who travel. The place, Los Angeles. 4 hours before his return flight to Portland, a salesman asked for his hotel bill and discovered that he didn't have a penny. $140 was missing. A problem? Not for this experienced traveler. His money was in American Express traveler's checks, the safe money. American Express in Los Angeles gave him a full refund right on the spot. Whenever you travel, be sure you carry American Express traveler's checks, the safe money. Safer than cash. Good everywhere. Prompt refund if lost or stolen. They cost just a penny per dollar. Buy them at your bank. American Express traveler's checks, the safe money. Safer than cash.
Well, you know, you can pursue this further, why he was such a loved character, but Dillinger was loved primarily because of that. You see, he was always doing things like that. One of the things he did when he was escaping from a holdup, and he jumped into a car. Their car conked out, and he jumped into a car, and there was a young man out for his Sunday drive with his young wife and their daughter. And so Dillinger gets in the car. He says, move over, we're going. And they start to go down the street, and the girl starts to cry. And the little girl in the back is crying. And Dillinger turns around. He says, "What's the matter, honey?" And she says, "Well, you know, you're crying." And the wife is very embarrassed, and she says, "Well, you know, she's embarrassed because she wanted an ice cream cone. She's still crying." Dillinger says, "Uh-oh, now wait a minute. Now let's stop here. They are being pursued by 15 cars. You know, down the street you can hear him coming around the corner." Then he says, wait a minute, let's now, just a minute. With that, he stops the car on the main street, goes into the drugstore, comes out with 3 double-deck ice cream cones, gives one to the girl, gives one to the guy, and has one for himself. He says, "I'll get you one, fella, but you're driving." And so on they go. It was part of the legend. This is exactly what Dillinger did. And so naturally, the people, they couldn't quite put this together with their idea of the thug, the real thug. Now, another thing Dillinger did, he was hung on the World's Fair. He loved to go to the Chicago World's Fair. Now, you don't often think of thugs doing this, and he wanted to go and ride on the sky ride all the time. Well, he had one strange little hobby. He had this box camera he took with him all the time. He wrote back. Can you imagine writing back to your niece? You're on the lam, you know. You're being chased all over the Midwest. They've chased you all the way through Iowa and Indiana and Kentucky, and you're on your way to Arizona, every place he was going. He writes back and he says, "Dear sis, we sure have been seeing a lot of the country. I'm just so sorry you haven't seen as much of it as I have seen. It's too bad we didn't have more time to enjoy it." You know, can you imagine him enjoying it? 3 o'clock in the morning, he's running roadblocks, and he's trying to look at the scenery of Arizona at the same time. He says, "Wow, look at that mountain over there." Boom! He says, "Hey, look at the statue." So you know, he was right out of the American tradition. He was purely part of that, because, you know, there's no question about it. If you're going to be really involved in truth, just for one brief moment, think about yourself for a minute now. Just really think about it. There is the one side of you that is the public side. That's the beautiful side. That's the side that likes law and order and likes everything to fit together. That's the idealistic, the abstract side, the side that believes in romance and beauty and truth and all the rest of it. And then there is that other side. There is that little other side that and everyone has the sneaking desire to grab a brick and throw it through the big window. Everyone really has this. So you cannot escape it. There's the other side of the lawless. Because after all, we are an island, you know. As much as we like to pretend we're all part of society, there's only one part of us that is. The other part is alone. The other part is at war with it. And the other part says, "Oh, boy, they're sure clamping me down. They're doing it to me." And this is what Dillinger literally played on. He didn't do it purposely. He didn't do it as a showbiz gambit. But he had both of these sides working very strongly. On the one side, it was obvious he was a family man. He loved his nieces and his nephews. He loved to play ball. He would. Do you know that one of his big jobs? This is a crazy little thing. One of his big jobs was thought up on a Sunday afternoon in the middle of a ball game. He was playing second base, and the guy that was with him was playing third base. And between innings, they worked up a big bank robbery. Sitting on the bench. Yeah, they were playing a ball game. Well, now this is not out of the tradition of the mafia. Not a bit of it. This is out of the tradition of Mooresville, Indiana. One more? Okay, speaking of bank robberies, let's give them another crack before we leave here.
Now, the reason the Accent Company has come all the way from Skokie, Illinois, to you boys here in Tin Pan Alley is to get some real music into our advertising. None of this jingle stuff. Do you understand?
You bet we do, don't we, Manny?
You can say that again, Wolfie.
Good. Now, I think something in between Hello, Dolly and some zither music would be nice.
Right. Something in between Hello. Can you give me that again?
Well, I like show tunes, but my wife likes zither music.
Yeah, but...
Of course, if you can't do it, I'll just have to go to...
No, you just sit right there, sir. Are you ready, Manny?
Anytime, Wolfie.
If nature puts the flavor in,
a little accent
helps to bring the flavor out.
A little accent
makes it easier to tell.
Hooray for accent!
What your meal is all about. Give your family a break.
A little accent
makes a steak taste like a steak.
Hooray for accent!
What it does for pot roast vegetables as well. Hello, accent.
Is that all you're going to use of hello?
Listen, we'll be lucky to get away with that.
Okay, all you latent gun mouths. My mother would be very embarrassed if she heard this, I'll tell you. You know, she would take it very seriously. She'd say, I don't know why you told everybody that. He says, it's very embarrassing. I just told it to you, and nobody really, nobody ever knew that. And so, to all of you latent gun mouths, to all of you basic, latent, untapped John Dillingers, keep your knees loose, keep your .38 oiled. You never know when the feds might be on the way, the rats!